I am Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. Today we talk about the erosion of wilderness protections. Although we haven't talked in 6 months, so I'm wondering if your 38 books is up to 43 or 47 by now.
No, it's not. I've been mostly focusing on writing editorials and essays, so, but no.
Okay, so the world goes 6 months without a book by you. We should stop the presses.
Right.
Okay, so, which I'm saying that because your work is so fantastic and I love that you are so hardworking. Anyways.
Well, thank you.
So today I want to talk about something that most people have not probably heard about, which is last December 13, the U.S. House Natural Resources Committee passed H.R. 1349I, the Mountain Bikes and Wilderness Bill. So can you talk about this and what is this? Why is this bad? And what is the larger aim of this particular push?
Sure. So what this bill would do would authorize all the federal agencies which have wilderness, which includes the Forest Service, the BLM, the National Park Service, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, to evaluate their lands that are presently part of the wilderness system, created by the 1964 Wilderness Act, to assess the trails that might be available and could be used by mountain bikes, and would authorize them to open up those trails to mountain biking. It would also encourage the agencies to basically encourage mountain biking as well. By that, maybe modifying trails or helping to create new trails in wilderness that could be ridden by mountain bikes. And to step back, the mountain biking community is divided on this issue, which is good to see. The International Mountain Biking Association, which is the largest mountain biking group in the country, is opposed to this bill. Their position is they support existing wilderness and feel that bikes would be inappropriate there. The people pushing this is a smaller offshoot of mountain bikers that have created what they call the Sustainable Trails Association. And they are, if I were to characterize it, they are sort of the expert mountain bikers, the aggressive mountain bikers, because a lot of trails that they seek to ride in wilderness areas as well as elsewhere are not things that a normal average person on a mountain bike could handle. So it's a smaller subset of mountain bikers that's pushing for this. And the problem, there are many. There's the more immediate problem of are mountain bikes appropriate in a lot of places, including wilderness. That's the first issue. And the second issue is who is supporting this in Congress? Well, it's being supported by some of the most anti-conservation, anti-environmentalist congressmen and senators. And so you have to say, well, why are they so anxious to, get mountain biking in places like wilderness areas, and including Secretary of Interior Zinke is one of them who has come out saying we need to have more bikes allowed in these areas. So that raises a red flag for me, because I think that this is more than about mountain biking. It's the way to weaken the intention of the Wilderness Act and then open up discussion and maybe eventually open up wilderness areas to many other forms of transportation, because after mountain bikers are permitted, then you have an argument saying, well, why don't we allow, for example, dirt bikes, or why don't we allow hovercraft, or why don't we allow jet skis? There are a lot of things that and recreational machines out there that people might then argue was unfair that they're excluded when mountain bikes are allowed. Now, this gets back to some of the misinformation from the people at the Sustainable Trails coalition or alliance or whatever they're called, they have said that the original Wilderness Act created in 1964 did not specifically exclude mountain bikes, which is true, partly because there was no such thing as a mountain bike in 1964. But what it did do is it said that no mechanical transport is allowed. And they said one of the purposes of the Wilderness Act is to reduce mechanization and the use of mechanized access into wildlands. So it specifically said no mechanical transport. And some of the bicycle advocates say, well, it didn't say bicycle, but it didn't say you can't use a jet ski or a snowmobile and a whole lot of other things. It didn't say you can't use a game cart, but game carts are also mechanical transport. So
it also didn't say that you can't use Tiger tanks or Sherman tanks or...
That's right. Bulldozers.
Yeah,
so they didn't specifically list a lot of these things. So the fact that they didn't list it doesn't mean that it isn't excluded because it did say no mechanical transport. So that's one of the myths. A second sort of false argument that I often hear from proponents is that well, mountain bikes are not as destructive to trails as, say, horses, which is permitted under the Wilderness Act. And there's two responses to that. One is horses were around at the time of the Wilderness Act and have been for a long time. And part of the Wilderness Act language is it's to encourage primitive means of access. And, you know, people have been riding horses for thousands of years. And the second part of it is even if you can argue that horses might do more damage to trails, which is true in some places, that doesn't mean that things are improved by also allowing mountain bikes. In other words, just because you have one activity that may not be as good as you might like or might have some damage, it doesn't mean adding another activity that also can create damage is appropriate. And so that's a second problem with it. A third problem that I see is sort of more ecological, and that is mechanical transport, whether it's a mountain bike or any other mechanical attribute, allows you to traverse areas faster and get to more remote areas. And part of the reason why people such as myself support designation of wilderness is that it creates more remote habitat for sensitive species. It provides a place where wildlife that might not mingle well with people have some refuge. And part of that refuge is just created by the sheer distances. So if you can traverse a trail in 10-mile trail, let's say, in 1 hour, an hour and a half, it might take somebody hiking 2 or 3 or 4 hours to do that same trail. You shrink the value of that conservation area. And so that's a problem. And then there's sort of a philosophical issue here too. And that is another thing that the Wilderness Act, attempts to do is, to get people to sort of slow down, notice their, environment and to, sort of have a greater connection to nature. And if you've ever ridden a mountain bike, and I have a mountain bike and I ride it, you don't take your eyes off the trail. You're just focused on what's right in front of you because it's very difficult to avoid having a crash if you're looking around. So the speed is not good. And that speed also has impacts on other users in the same way that snowmobiles and ski cross-country skiers don't usually get along. When a mountain bike comes down a trail fast and suddenly comes around a bend, it can, you can have accidents with hikers and also fast horses are very skittish about mountain bikes. So you might have accidents that way. So it's just it creates a more tense environment and place, in these areas. And one other aspect of it is, a lot of the people that are advocating for this are sort of more interested, I would call, in claiming that they rode this bike to this peak or whatever. They're sort of bragging rights, I guess is the way to say it. And, of course, that's involved with a lot of people in a lot of different activities. But You know, I'm proud of the fact if I hike 15 miles in a day or 20 miles in a day, I tell my friends about it, of course. But it still seems to be that is a more dominant rationale for the mountain biking. And if you look at the, particularly, I did a recent survey of mountain bike magazines, and every one of the covers shows some guy. If you look at the iconology, they're always guys for one thing. If you look at the iconology, they're all wearing the shirts with, you know, labels of different companies on them. They've got, you know, helmets and goggles, and they look for all intents and purposes like dirt bikers, and they're always halfway in the air. You know, it's all of, and they have things like, you know, conquer the mountain, and this whole idea of domination seems to be part of the more aggressive mountain bike community mindset. So that in itself, again, a philosophical thing, but that's one of the things we're trying to counter with wilderness, is to get away from this idea of domination and to have restraint and humility. And those are the values that are achieved, or at least the desired outcome of people having a wilderness experience. And finally, the Wilderness Act doesn't really say much about recreation. And so this is not about preserving recreational opportunities per se. It's about protecting wilderness and wildlands, and the wildness is the primary purpose of the Wilderness Act. So it's not like who gets to do what recreational activities on these lands. So that's why that bill is a threat, ultimately, because I think that it changes the whole ambiance and goals that were set aside by the original Wilderness Act, and creates an opportunity, and this gets back to who's sponsoring, creates an opportunity for the people who are interested in degrading or reducing environmental laws, regulations, and so forth, an opportunity to sort of open up these lands to other uses, and eventually, you know, it'll be fine to have bulldozers, you know, recreational bulldozing in wilderness. Why shouldn't we, right? I mean, everybody has a right to that kind of recreation. So I'm being somewhat absurd there, but it's not beyond the pale that that wouldn't happen. So that's the problem with this particular bill. But I would also say that I see it as a bigger threat beyond just the existing wilderness, because what we're seeing all around the West is and probably in the East Coast too, but I'm most familiar with the West. What we're seeing all around the West is areas that have been set aside, or at least recognized as potential new wilderness areas. For example, you have wilderness study areas that aren't designated by Congress as wilderness yet, but have been set aside where they have to maintain the wilderness values. And a lot of the federal agencies haven't done much to exclude mountain biking from those areas, if anything. And that means that they then get a constituency utilizing those areas who then become vocal opponents to that ever being set aside as wilderness. So, for example, in Montana, there was a bill created in 1977 called Senate Bill 393 that set aside, I believe at the original time, about 10 roadless areas that were supposed to be protected as wilderness study areas for future designation as wilderness. And most of those areas haven't been dealt with one way or another. And recently, to their credit, for example, the Bitterroot National Forest had two of these wilderness study areas on the National Forest. They had the what was called the Blue Joint Wilderness Study Area and the Sapphire Wilderness Study Area. And they determined that mountain biking in those areas was inappropriate. So, before this, mountain bikes had been using the area. So now you have this group of mountain bikers who are saying, you're taking away my recreational opportunity here to go into the Sapphires or the Blue Joint. And it's going to make it much harder to get those areas as designated wilderness. And the same thing is happening to another proposed wilderness area south of Bozeman called the Gallatin. Its original name was Highlight Porcupine Buffalo Horn Wilderness Study Area, but it's the Gallatin Range. And again, because of existing mountain bike use that has built up in the area, a lot of it is the mountain bikers are opposed to wilderness in it. And the original wilderness study area was 155,000 acres, And the Forest Service is doing its forest plan. It's come out with a recommendation of only 83,000 acres, and they cut off a big area called the Buffalo Horn and calling it a backcountry area so that mountain bikers can continue to use it. And that area, if there is any area in the Gallatin Range that has ecological importance, that is the place. It's really used by a lot of grizzly bears. It's a place where bison could colonize coming out of Yellowstone Park. It's got wolverine. It's got migrating elk. It's a fabulous area. And so if you're interested in conserving biodiversity, you should be supporting wilderness for that area. And yet, and this is where it gets even slippier, a lot of the conservation groups in Montana have tried to have collaborative talks with mountain bikers, and they're not supporting wilderness for the Buffalo Horn either because of the strong mountain biking opposition. So this is the theory, the problem I see going forward, where the mountain bike community is not usually supportive of wilderness, or the ones that are overshadowed, so to speak, by those who oppose wilderness. One more example: there's another wilderness study area in Wyoming near Jackson called the Palisades Wilderness Study Area, and recently the Congressman Cheney from Wyoming has introduced legislation to open up that area to mountain biking again because of the aggressive mountain biking community in Jackson that feels like they are being excluded from that area. So it's a growing problem, and I fear that we're going to have a much more difficult time getting designated wilderness because of this constituency, which a lot of environmental groups seem to love to oppose, and probably in all likelihood because many of the people in, you know, various so-called wilderness advocacy groups ride mountain bikes themselves. So they don't want to necessarily see these areas closed or whatever. But it's strange to me that in this day and age, going back to Montana as an example, where, 20 years ago, the wilderness advocacy groups were much more aggressive about supporting maximum wilderness acreage for wilderness designation, and now they're shy about it. And it was much, you had opponents, you know, logging companies, mining companies, all these other things in the past. It should be easier than ever before to get wilderness designated, and they seem to be capitulating before they even get started.
So I want to ask you about the importance of wilderness and the momentum. You know, 1964, they were able to get a law passed, and by now, you know, I almost never hear even a lot of environmental organizations talk about wilderness. So I want to go there in a second, but before I do that, there are three or four images that came to mind that I want to just say, and then you can respond to these any way you want. One of them is that my mom is elderly and functionally blind. I mean, she can see, but she doesn't have great vision. And she has talked for years about how walking in a town, she has almost been run over any number of times by bicyclists. And this is on a sidewalk. And so I just wanted to throw that in terms of what you're saying about human mountain bike interactions. Another thing I want to mention is that, there was a couple of things. One is I read this article in Wild Earth back in the 90s that has always stuck with me. I think about this almost every day when I walk through the forest about how it was an article about going barefoot. And it was saying that when we put on shoes as opposed to moccasins or going barefoot, we turn ourselves from a soft padded mammal to a hooved mammal in terms of our effect on the ground. And it's always stuck with me. And then I think when you go to a mountain bike, you're moving that just one more step further in terms of compaction, in terms of crushing beings. And that leads to the third thing and final thing I want to mention right now, which is, even if you walk along a bike path, you will still see, crushed newts and lizards and all sorts of small beings who would have been less likely to be crushed on by people walking. And so I'm just throwing those things out in terms of people might consider, I mean, compared to clear cutting, those are all small, but those are all still effects I think are real.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the speed factor is a big part of the problem. The thing is, if you're, quote, an environmental group and you're not supporting wilderness, you're not supporting the gold standard. Wilderness, and in many cases national parks, are proven to be the most effective way to conserve habitat and biodiversity and ecological processes. Now, we can all recognize that, you know, there are problems with these, mostly because we don't have enough areas protected. C.O. Wilson has come out recently, and the World Congress on Protected Areas and various other organizations have all come out in recognition that we ought to be protecting at least half of the earth. And so when a conservation group comes up with something less than that, I'll give you one other example where mountain bikers compromised a proposal. The largest roadless area left in the Cascades near Bend, Oregon, called the Maiden Peak Roadless Area. It's been proposed for many years to be designated as wilderness. And the Sierra Club came out with a proposal they call Wild Waldo, or something like that, referring to Waldo Lake, which this Maiden Peak is adjacent to. And the mountain bikers objected to including Maiden Peak in the proposal because some people ride up to the top of Maiden Peak. And so, trying to be good guys, or more inclusive, the Sierra Club came up with a proposal that names it a conservation area or some other name like that. And ultimately, that area is not going to be wilderness if their position gets carried forward. And to me, it's just unconscionable that the Sierra Club would not be advocating for wilderness for that area. So this is the kind of thing that's going on, as groups have enter into these collaboratives. That's part of the problem, but the other problem is that they're being fooled into supporting measures that have less ecological certainty than what we get with wilderness designation. And again, wilderness is the gold standard, and we should be, as environmentalists, trying to get as much designated wilderness as possible, not compromising on that right from the beginning and willing to take things off the table entirely or changing the designation to something less protected than wilderness.
This all makes me think of something that you and I have worked on independently and also spoken of together, which is a dreadful transformation of so much environmentalism away from being about wild places and wild things and toward toward basically trying to recreate. And, you know, both you and I enjoy being in forests, that's no doubt, but it seems to me that if you're looking at a wild place as some place for someone to ride their bike, that is a fundamentally different perspective than looking at it primarily as a refuge for grizzly bears and for various beetles who don't like to cross open spaces.
Exactly. I know you're the same way too, but I support wilderness designation for a whole lot of places that I'll never get to. And I do it on the philosophical basis that, we need more protected lands. This is the way we pay our debt to the earth. We all have benefited from exploitation of the earth, and for a whole host of reasons, we need to, any place that can possibly qualify as wilderness should be protected as wilderness. That's one of the best laws we have in this country for protecting lands, and it's one of our strongest laws. As you know, one can make all these economic arguments like it's good for your local economy, it's good to provide clean water for people, and so forth. So there's all these human dimensions to it. But ultimately, I think at least some of us, want to do this because we feel it's the right thing to do for everything else living on Earth and all the other creatures that need a home. And we need to share the planet with these creatures, and we need to maintain to the greatest degree possible the ecological processes, many of which cannot operate in places that are actively managed for something like timber production or something like that, to allow those ecological processes that have shaped evolution to continue. And that's one of the values, and probably the biggest value of wilderness, not whether I hike there or anybody else can go ski there or float a canoe or whatever. Although I think that those are appropriate activities within limits, but we don't need to add to the recreation impacts. And people have to be aware, even recreation, though, as you point out, it may not be as severe as might happen with a clear cut or livestock grazing, but there are still, at some point, cumulative impacts. So one of the things, again, about wilderness is that it tends to promote restraint and a different way of looking at the landscape. And I think that those are important values that we need to maintain and we need to expand upon. And wilderness helps us, at least some of us, to see a different relationship with the earth. And that's something that we need to get more widespread across our whole population.
So I want to tell a brief wilderness story, and then I want to ask a question about the Wilderness Act itself. And the brief story is, I remember one time being in the Rewa Wilderness area in Colorado, and I was the only person there except for a wilderness ranger, a federal employee who had the delightful job of hiking wilderness areas to make sure people weren't camping too near streams. It seems like a pretty good job. And anyway, so I was having this wonderful time until I was sitting up near this lake, and all of a sudden I could hear this huge party of people shouting and yelling and just being really obnoxious. And I didn't have as good a time after that. And my point is, there was something, I don't know, there was something, it almost felt like a bunch of people coming in and screaming and yelling and getting drunk in a church or something. I don't know what point I'm trying to make exactly, but I just know that making the access, and you and I both agree that wheelchairs are allowed and should be allowed insofar as there are paths, of course. So it wasn't that, but there was a certain rowdiness that, I don't know. Is this meaning anything to you? Do you want to take this anywhere, or do you want me to just go on?
No. I understand what you're saying, and that is one of the things that if you have humility and reverence for the landscape, you wouldn't be so noisy and so forth. And that's the problem with that I see with mountain biking, for example, is it promotes this idea of conquering and domination and so forth. Just read the mountain. Just go. Go online and Google mountain biking magazines and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. That's what all the articles are about and what the covers are about. And that is not the kind of, you know, and then compare that to, you know, most, you know, Google wilderness scene with person and there'll be somebody sitting quietly near a serene lake. You know, it's a whole different ambiance and goal that is being promoted there. And I think that that is, it's an important difference and distinction that's not recognized, of course, by the mountain bikers themselves for the most part because they don't seem to be aware of it. The other part of it, too, that I think this gets at is what are we trying to do by accommodating every single use? Just because somebody bought a bicycle, do they have a right to use it on public lands? Well, you know, I'm not saying that maybe we should eliminate it on all public lands, but I mean, so I could buy a bulldozer and make the same argument. You know, I've got a bulldozer now, so I should be allowed to use it. Well, no, not necessarily. there are things on public lands that we tend to limit. There are a lot of parks, for example. You mentioned being loud and drinking. There are a lot of county and city parks where you can't just go and, you know, have a big party and get drunk. It's against the law because that seems inappropriate in the park, or it's inappropriate in the church. It's inappropriate in a lot of these places. So we recognize that there are places that kind of approach and behavior is an invasion of what the area is supposed to be promoting. And I make the same argument about mountain biking in general. It promotes a sort of an aggressive worldview, and that worldview is not appropriate in our wilderness areas. And as I tried to say, I don't think it's appropriate in any place that's been seriously considered for wilderness, because I don't want to see these areas not get their due as protected wilderness by allowing a use to get established there that would disqualify it for wilderness protection. And, I hear from people all the time, well, mountain bikers could be our allies. Well, you know, I'm not looking for allies if the only reason they're supporting my position is for their own selfish interests. I see that as weak allies and ones that are not going to be good in the end. I'm happy to try to convince mountain bikers that wilderness is a good thing, and hope that they'll recognize that and why it's inappropriate for mountain biking there. But then I'd be happy to call them as allies then, but not just to say, well, if we accommodate your use, will you support this area for some sort of protected status? And that's a slippery slope in my mind, and may very well end up impoverishing our whole conservation system as a result.
So I've got yet another question before we go to the Wilderness Act of 64, which is that living in Del Norte, which is extremely conservative and very anti-environmental for the most part, one of the arguments I hear all the time against anybody who wants to take out roads or to prevent future roads from being pushed in is that we're a bunch of elitists because we want to prevent people from experiencing. I mainly hear this about getting off-road vehicles off of land. They say that we're an elitist because we want to deny people access. So because I'm sure you get this all the time too, how do you respond to that regarding this particular issue?
Well, I start out with by saying that only 2.7% of the lower 48 states is designated wilderness, for one thing. And even if you took all the remaining land that possibly could qualify, you might possibly get up to 5 or 6% of the lower 48 states as designated wilderness, which means that the vast majority of the country is already available for people who want to ride bicycles or motorcycles or snowmobiles or whatever, including the majority of public lands, too, I might add, but also a lot of private lands that would never qualify as wilderness. If you're talking about compromise, and the idea of compromising, we passed that point a long time ago. That's why I say every last acre that could possibly qualify as wilderness should be protected, because we have already developed the vast majority of the American landscape, and it is available to all those people who want to ride their dirt bikes or ORVs or jet skis or snowmobiles or ride their mountain bikes or whatever. And we're just talking about the last little drips and drabs and saying, can't we just set those aside? I mean, is that asking too much? I don't think it's unreasonable at all. And especially if you take the idea that some ecologists are promoting that we need to protect upwards of 50% of the earth from resource development. How are we going to get there if we only have 2.7% in the lower 40 states? That means a whole lot more areas need to come under some sort of conservation guise, and certainly the first place to start is with all the roadless areas that could qualify as wilderness, and then from there the passive recovery of areas that have been previously exploited, like, for example, you know, in New England, a lot of that area was cleared for farming and it's grown back into forests, and a lot of animals have recolonized it that were extirpated. So that's a passive recovery, and that's another way we get at that 50%.
So we have about 10 to 13 minutes left, and before we wind down, I want to get to a question that, for me, goes to the heart of a lot of this, which is, how the hell did the Wilderness Act ever get passed in the first place? What was different? Because I can't imagine, I mean, in my adult lifetime, I have seen nothing but erosion, for the most part, of the Endangered Species Act, of the Clean Water Act, of the Wilderness Act. I've seen erosions. I've not seen the environmental movement be able to mount any sort of great offensives where we had great things happen. What made that happen?
Well, there were a couple of things going on. I'll give you a quick history. The Wilderness Society was formed in 1935, and the membership of that society was a pretty illustrious list of some of the top biologists and wildland thinkers of the time. Aldo Leopold, Bob Marshall, Olis Meary, among others. And I might add that all of them had extensive personal experience in wildlands too. So they were passionate about protecting wildlands. And they formed the Wilderness Society. And the Wilderness Society, it took from 1935 until 64 to get away, but their goal is to set up a wilderness system. And there were 66 versions of the Wilderness Act rewritten and introduced between the early 1950s and 64 when it passed, with many compromises along the way, in fact, because the original version that was being advocated by the Wilderness Society, ironically back then, would have protected all the roadless lands left in the United States under the Act, which unfortunately didn't make it through. But one of the things was, is I think that the part of these, the people behind this, recognized that wildlands were being lost yearly. Bob Marshall, who formed the Wilderness Society, I'm going to paraphrase him because I don't have it right in front of me, said, we don't want any stragglers as members of the Wilderness Society because, and we don't want people whose first instinct is to compromise because too much good wilderness has been lost already by those kinds of folks. And it's ironic that the Wilderness Society today, I wish they would be following Bob Marshall, who was their founder's philosophy, because they're some of the first ones that will compromise on this in a lot of cases. So anyway, so we got that through, and then I think it was a period in the up into the 50s and the 60s when you had all sorts of activism on all sorts of things. That's when the Civil Rights Act was passed. That's when the Vietnam War was occurring, and there was opposition. And I think that people of that era, though, of course, there were a lot of people harmed in conflicts and so forth over civil rights in Vietnam, etc., they found that by being politically active, they could change the world, so to speak. And I think that people have gotten more passive today and maybe haven't had that experience. That's my only theory. I don't think, you know, you could say people were smarter then or had anything different that way, but they had a passion for protecting wildland, and I think maybe today there's that a lot of that passion has been lost, and so people are kind of less willing to put their lives on the line, so to speak, whether physically or just emotionally and philosophically, to promote this idea of protecting wildlands.
So now we have about 6 or 7 minutes left, and two questions to sort of wind down. Mm-hmm. One of them would be, what can people do to oppose this particular bill? And then, mm-hmm, more importantly, I think, what can people do, no matter where they are, to actively promote increase in wilderness areas and a disallowing of weakening of protection of wilderness areas, both?
Okay, well, there's two different answers. The first I would say is the most important thing you can do is contact your congressional representative. And you don't, I actually talked to a congressman this last week, and he told me, look, you don't have to know a whole lot of detail. All I need to do is hear from you that you don't support this or you support that particular legislation. You don't have to go into the details. So you don't have to be an expert about arguing why mountain bikes might not be appropriate or what the Wilderness Act originally said or anything else. All you have to do is write your congressmen or senators and say, if this legislation comes forward, please oppose it. And at the same time, you should also write your local newspaper, because one thing the congressional representatives do is they look at the local newspaper letters to the editors, and they figure that every letter to the editor is equivalent to the thought of a couple of hundred other people. So if you're going to write your congressman in the first place or call them, send a short note to the local newspaper also about that. And, again, you don't have to know the intimate details. You just have to have the general idea in mind and get that, express that. Now, the second part of what you were talking about, how do we get more wilderness and so forth, one of the ways that people should be aware of right now is that many of these national forests around the country are going through what they call the forest planning process. And these forest plans are supposed to be renewed every 10 years. They tend to get dragged out often 20 years or more. And in those forest plans, one of the things that they have to do is evaluate any roadless areas for its potential as wilderness. And, for example, the Custer Gallatin Forest in Montana just came out with its draft plan, and I went through it, and they had all these areas that mostly they were recommending against wilderness, a few areas where they were recommending some wilderness. And I just encourage people to get involved, and if you know of a roadless area around you or several, to when the Forest Service is taking comment, write in, because one of the things with a lot of these federal agencies, there are a lot of good people that work for federal agencies, actually, that are probably sympathetic, at least to some of the positions that you and I are discussing. But they need the political cover to do the right thing. And if, for example, 500 people were to write in on the Custer-Gallatin plan saying we want more wilderness here and there, the Forest Service could, maybe not, but it could then have the political cover to maybe expand its wilderness recommendations. So that's an example. The other is to, of course, vote. And we know that elections have consequences. Right now, we have one of the most anti-environmental administrations that I haven't seen in my whole life. And I used to think that James Watt and Reagan were bad, but nothing compared to what we have now. And so you have to try to get people elected that are going to be supportive of protecting land and keeping environmental laws intact. One of the other bills out there, this is just an aside, but this whole border wall thing having to do with immigration, there are a number of bills that would allow the Homeland Security to do build roads, put in helicopter landing pads, all sorts of surveillance stuff within 100 miles of the border, on all the borders. So 100 miles of the south of the Canadian border and 100 miles north of the Mexican border. Well, what's in that area? Well, in terms of wilderness just alone, there are 32 million acres of designated wilderness that falls within that 100-mile zone, including places like the North Cascades National Park, Olympic National Park, Glacier National Park, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, Glacier Bay National Park, the Wrangell Mountains National Park, and then down the southern border, Cabrera National Wildlife Refuge, Ordnance National Park, etc. So that bill would waive 38 or 36, something like that, environmental regulations, including the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, the Wilderness Act, the Endangered Species Act, etc. So these other bills are a real threat, too, and to wildlands, and people have to start paying attention to them. So I encourage one place you can keep up on at least the threats directly to wilderness is a group called Wilderness Watch in Missoula, Montana. You can go on their site, but they list all these legislations that are a threat to wilderness, and that would be a good place to start if anybody's interested.
Well, thank you so much for all of your constant work on Defense of the Wild. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.